Have you ever looked at an organization, maybe seen its name, and then realized there's this incredibly deep, complex story behind it, like a surprising origin and a global reach you just wouldn't expect?
Oh, absolutely. Sometimes the simplest names hide the most fascinating structures.
Exactly. And today we're diving into one of those stories. We're peeling back the layers, and I think you're going to find it pretty compelling. Our mission here in this deep dive is to unpack three organizations that are really intertwined: the Ecumenical Institute, the Institute of Cultural Affairs, and something called the Order. Ecumenical.
Right. Three distinct names, but deeply connected.
Yeah, we want to trace their different purposes, dig into their shared history, which has some real surprises, and then reveal that, well, the huge impact they've had on communities worldwide.
And we've got some great source material that lays out this whole evolution and their reach. It's quite a story of change.
It really is. So let's start by getting a handle on these three groups. The Ecumenical Institute, or EI, what was its main goal initially?
Well, its original purpose was pretty clear: serve and renew the Christian church, basically make it more effective in society.
How did they do that?
Through education, mainly. They had programs like an 8-week academy, a 3-week international training institute. And it's interesting, it was officially incorporated as a nonprofit in Illinois back in 1964.
All right.
But its roots actually go back to an initiative from the Church Federation of Greater Chicago.
Got it. And then came the Institute of Cultural Affairs, the ICA. How did that connect? Was it an offshoot or?
Well, legally it was distinct, but very much related. The ICA's focus shifted more towards, let's say, comprehensive community renewal.
Okay, more practical.
Exactly. Motivating cooperative action through field work, through research. Think of it as the kind of the practical on-the-ground arm.
Right.
So the ICA provides training, planning, helping people implement, social and economic change.
Yeah.
And today, it's got branches in 40 countries. It's like this informal federation of autonomous nonprofits.
Wow, 40 countries. That's significant. And then underpinning both of these, you mentioned the order, ecumenical. That sounds like the real foundation.
It absolutely was. You could call it the foundational support structure. It provided all the training staff, the research staff for both the EI and the ICA.
For both,
Okay.
okay.
But what makes it really unique is its self-supporting model. The members, who came from all sorts of professions, they actually contributed their salaries.
Their entire salary.
Their salaries, yeah, into a common fund. And this fund covered basically everything: health, education, welfare costs for the staff and their families for as long as they were members.
That's a huge commitment. How did that work day to day, especially with families involved?
That's a great question. And it really shows the depth of their commitment, right? It wasn't just about money. It was almost like a living example of their mission. When the order incorporated in 1973, it was designed to be inclusive. You had people from diverse religious backgrounds, families, single people, all voluntarily committing to this life of service.
A structured community life.
Exactly. Focused on creative renewal in society. And what's key is the order itself. It didn't run programs, it didn't raise funds. Its whole purpose was just providing the people, the dedicated human resources.
That level of shared sacrifice, it does make you think, could that be a key to long-term impact that maybe other groups miss?
It's definitely a powerful thought.
Yeah.
And connecting this back, it sounds like all three entities, EI, ICA, the Order, they had quite a diverse support network.
Precisely. Support came from individuals, foundations, corporations, service organizations, churches, a real mix. Some specific projects even got government agency support,
Okay.
and the boards for EI and ICA in different countries. They were made up of unsalaried people from business, professional fields, religious communities, civic life, which really speaks to that broad trust and buy-in.
Right, that broad base is important.
Okay, so we have the structure. How did this all actually start? The origins seem tied pretty deeply to the post-World War II era, right?
Yeah, very much so. The Christian church was facing some big questions after the war. You had major reviews happening, like the World Council of Churches meeting in Evanston, Illinois in 1954, and Vatican II as well.
And that Evanston meeting was key.
It was. That's where a resolution was passed to set up a layman's training center in North America. And the inspiration came directly from an existing place, the Ecumenical Institute of Bassi in Switzerland.
So a direct response to that call.
You see it happen pretty quickly.
Yeah.
In 1956, some Christian businessmen in Chicago acted on that WCC resolution. They founded the Evanston Institute of Ecumenical Studies and even invited Dr. Walter Liebrecht over from Germany to direct it.
Ah, okay. Direct action.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, something else really interesting was developing down in Texas.
Right, the Texas connection.
At the University of Texas, yeah. A group of students and staff formed what they called the Christian Faith and Life Community. It was founded by Reverend W. Jack Lewis, who'd been a naval chaplain.
And what were they focused on?
They were really digging into how their faith related practically to contemporary life. They look at experimental lay communities in Europe for inspiration, places like Tyes and Iona.
Hmm, those intentional communities.
Exactly. So this group developed this shared life, worship, study, mission. They created a curriculum led by Dr. Joseph W. Matthews. Part of this was a residential seminar, Religious Studies I, or RSI. They taught it to local congregations, student groups.
You know, it makes you wonder how radical that must have seemed then, this idea of a living, working, intentional faith community.
Oh, it was incredibly forward-thinking, especially how they were trying to integrate faith directly into the issues of the day, not just keep it theoretical.
Right.
And here's where it all comes together. Dr. Liebrecht went back to Germany in 1962. So the Church Federation of Greater Chicago reorganized that Evanston Center, renamed it the Ecumenical Institute.
And invited Dr. Matthews from Texas.
Exactly. They invited Dr. Matthews to be the dean. And this was the pivotal moment. Seven families from that Christian Faith and Life community in Texas decided to move up to Chicago with him.
Wow.
As unpaid volunteer corporate teaching staff.
So they brought that whole communal living model with them.
Pretty much. They kept developing the curriculum for churches, but they were also researching, like, what does a modern Christian community actually look like?
How do you structure that?
Right. So they studied historical religious orders.
Yeah.
And they started modeling their own community on what are known as third orders or family orders.
Okay. What does third order mean in this context?
Think of it like this. Instead of monks or nuns in a cloister, it's individuals and families committing to a shared life of service, but within the wider society.
Ah, okay. Integrated, not separated.
Exactly. Their corporate lifestyle wasn't just about living together. It meant pooling resources, dedicating their professional skills entirely to the organization's mission. It created this incredibly dedicated, self-sustaining workforce.
That commitment that became the origin of the order, ecumenical.
That's it. Hmm. It really shows how a shared philosophy can grow into something so structured, so self-sacrificing.
So from these really unique beginnings, things started to expand. Programs grew, and the reach became global quite fast, actually.
Yeah, the practical application started almost immediately. In 1963, those seven families who had moved up to Chicago, they started an experiment.
The Fifth City Project.
That's the one. A practical experiment in comprehensive community development. They moved right into a West Side Chicago ghetto, known then as Fifth City. This wasn't just some side project. It was like their living lab.
To test that core idea.
Exactly. The idea that the local community is the fundamental building block of society and that deep grassroots action could actually transform it.
So how did they approach it?
Very hands-on. Yes. Door-to-door interviews, neighborhood meetings.
Yeah.
Really trying to empower residents to name the problems and design solutions themselves.
Mm.
And it led to, believe it or not, 45 different social and economic development programs, all driven by volunteers and local corporate effort. It really demonstrates that power of local buy-in.
And the curriculum they brought from Texas, that evolved too.
It did, yeah. It kind of split into two mainstreams. You had the Institute of Religious Studies that stayed focused on biblical theological stuff.
Right.
And then the Institute of Cultural Studies, which tackled contemporary society, changing attitudes, societal dynamics.
So broadening the focus.
Definitely. And these seminars, they weren't small. Hundreds of lay people, clergy from many different countries came through them. They were grappling with the relevance of the Christian message in a changing world, but also just understanding how society worked.
That shift seems like a classic organizational move, right? Adapting to where your values can have the biggest impact.
Absolutely. Moving beyond just serving the church institutionally to addressing broader societal needs.
So by 1964, groups started coming to the Ecumenical Institute, seeing how relevant these seminars were for their own communities.
Right. And that demand led EI to develop more advanced research and training programs. They started a summer research assembly in 1965. Apparently, it's been held every year since.
Wow.
Okay, drawing up to 1,000 people from all over the globe each year. And the focus was always on creating and refining practical methods. How can we actually serve local communities better?
And this led to bigger training initiatives.
Two key ones emerged around this time. The Academy, that was the 8-week course mixing religious and cultural seminars.
Okay.
And then the International Training Institute, the ITI, That was 6 weeks, based on the academy, but with a much stronger emphasis on practical fieldwork.
Getting hands dirty.
Exactly. The very first ITI was held in Singapore in 1969. Had 102 people from 23 different nations.
That's impressive for a first run.
It is. And from there, it just exploded. ITI started popping up all over Africa, India, North and South America, Australia, Europe, even Western Samoa.
This is where the growth really takes off, isn't it? The numbers become kind of mind-boggling.
They really do. Think about this. In 1968, they had just over 100 staff, all living there in Fifth City.
Right.
By 1974, so just 6 years later, they had 1,500 staff.
1,500?
Yep. Working in over 100 offices across 20 nations.
That's staggering growth. 15 times the staff in 6 years. The logistics alone.
Unbelievable, right? It speaks volumes about how replicable their methods seem to be and just the sheer demand for that kind of approach.
Mm-hmm.
They had to set up coordinating centers, Bombay, Hong Kong, Chicago, Brussels, Kuala Lumpur, just to manage it all. A truly global operation.
And they weren't just setting up offices. They were actively testing these methods in really different places, weren't they?
That's a key point. They were very deliberate. After analyzing what worked in Fifth City, the Institute would accept invitations to try things out in completely different environments.
Like where?
Well, places as diverse as a remote Aboriginal settlement in Australia or a tiny South Pacific island in the Marshall Islands.
Wow. Talk about test and adaptability.
Exactly. These were intentional experiments. Can these core methods work here? What needs to change? They weren't just expanding. They were learning and refining in incredibly varied contexts.
And the practical tools kept developing, too. You mentioned Lenin-S earlier.
Right, Lenin-S. That came about because a lot of professional and business volunteers were helping out on these projects as consultants.
Okay.
They saw the planning methods being used and basically asked the Institute, hey, can you design a seminar to show how these methods could apply to other kinds of groups and situations?
Makes sense.
So that led to Lenin-S leadership effectiveness and new strategies. And it took off. It's been used globally by social agencies, governments, even private businesses.
So by 1974, the ICA, which had kind of taken over the more practical side, started grouping its work into major programs.
Yeah, they bundled things into three main areas. First was the Human Development Program, or HDP.
Okay.
This was designed for local communities, rural or urban, based on those early project methods, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Since 75, they launched over 300 pilot projects in 25 nations.
How did an HDP typically start?
Usually with a week-long consultation. The community, outside consultants, ICA staff, all getting together to hammer out a 4-year development plan.
Real examples.
Oh, yeah. The New Village Movement in Maharashtra, India, that involved 232 villages. Similar big efforts happened in Kenya, Indonesia, the Philippines. These weren't just isolated projects. They were like a suite of tools they'd developed.
Okay. HDP was one. What were the others?
Second was the Community Forum Program. This used simpler workshop methods right in community meetings. The goal was to clarify what the main concerns were and create practical action plans using local resources and cooperation.
Sounds very grassroots.
Very. They held over 1,000 of these forums just in 13 European countries. And they adapted it too, creating things like the Global Women's Forum and the Community Youth Forum.
Okay. And the third program?
That was Research, Training, and Interchange. This was about continuing a learning and sharing process involving ICA staff, those volunteer consultants, local people all around the world.
And a key part of that was training.
Definitely. The Human Development Training Institute came out of this. It's been used extensively. India, the Philippines, South Korea, Africa, Indonesia, training community leaders, village volunteers, government field workers, really focused on scaling up that local capacity.
That commitment to training local leaders seems crucial for sustainability.
Absolutely. Empowering people on the ground.
So this incredible journey keeps evolving. We get to the late 80s, and the Institute of Cultural Affairs International, ICAI, is formed.
Right. In September 1989, ICA staff met in Brussels. The idea behind creating ICAI was really symbolic to unify the global institutes. It was a big step towards that federated model we talked about.
And this is where they formally captured some of their methods.
Yeah, this is where they really systematized what had worked like the Fifth City approach into something they call the technology of participation. This became central to ICI's leadership training.
Makes sense to codify what works.
And then, at a global conference in Prague in 1992, they nailed down 4 primary objectives that still guide them. Sustainable development, organizational transformation, pedagogy, which is teaching methods, and international dialogue.
Still relevant goals today.
Very much so. And they even added two more in 2000, community youth development and sustainable community development. So constantly adapting to current needs.
So what does that mean for how IPI works now? What's their approach today?
They've really leaned into what they call a peer-to-peer model. It's very regionalized.
Meaning
it empowers the national ICAs, the local branches, to set their own priorities, lead their own activities, make decisions. It ensures things are relevant locally, but they still maintain that global connection. It's much less top-down, much more about adapting to specific community contexts.
That sounds like a healthy evolution for a global network.
It seems to be working for them.
So when you step back and look at this whole deep dive,
yeah,
it's quite a journey, isn't it, from theological discussions after WWII.
Right, that initial focus on renewing the church.
To this robust global network focused on really practical community development and social change, the adaptability is remarkable.
It really is. And this story, I think, it reinforces that idea that sometimes an initial spark, like a desire for spiritual renewal, can genuinely evolve into something massive, a framework for global impact.
Yeah.
It really highlights the power you can get from a structured community, from having that shared purpose, and from developing methods that you can actually adapt and use widely.
It's a powerful combination, which leaves us, and you listening, with a final thought to chew on.
Mm.
What might actually be possible if more organizations, whatever their starting point, committed to that kind of long-term vision, you know, locally driven action but connected globally, really focused on addressing societal needs head on?